The title of this talk is Free Will, Its Nature and Possibility in Light of the Natural and Supernatural. Due to time constraints, I'm going to mainly focus on a so-called natural approach to free will, as well as some common criticisms of it, and we'll touch on free will as it relates to divine providence at the end. So free will is a valuable and intuitive notion. What are some common assumptions that many of us have about free will? One, we have the ability to actualize distinct possibilities. Two, we have some meaningful degree of autonomy. And three, we are responsible for our choices. I think all of these are fairly recognizable by us. In fact, you often hear the view espoused by those prone to pathological behavior, say your Ted Bundys or your Marquis de Sades, that they do not believe they are free in some fundamental way, that they have no personal freedom. As philosopher P.F. Strawson has pointed out, we tend to depersonalize when impacted by non-free action. For example, let's say that, you know, you're walking down the hall and someone comes up to you and pushes you violently against the wall. At first, you start thinking, you know, what is wrong with this person? Why would they do this to me? You know, that's no way to treat me. But after finding out, let's say, that a person has a mental disorder or is under some sort of influence, one immediately sort of changes their attitude towards that person to a more depersonalized position and start thinking about that person as a product of certain influence, physical influences upon their behavior. So this idea of free will is in fact a very basic way through which we understand the world around us and those people that we interact with on a day-to-day basis. Two major points to keep in mind, though, as I go through this complicated section on the nature of free will. A. Free will involves contingency without being arbitrary and is determinative without being deterministic. A speaks to a false dichotomy between actions as determinative and actions as arbitrary. Free will has identities and differences with both sides. B. Free will is our capacity to engage in particular actions beyond an indifferent generic cognitive state. Philosopher Peter Vanenwagen once complained that although he knows that we have free will, he has no idea what it is. As we'll see, B hopefully tells us a little more about what in fact free will is. So let's discuss the nature and possibility of free will, and let's start with a rather classic definition of it. 1. Free will is the ability to do otherwise, or the ability to take one thing while refusing another. Notice that this definition doesn't include what ultimately is good for oneself, such as when we say, although her dissolute lifestyle is what she wanted, she is a slave to it, and so is not free. On the definition we're using, such a person would indeed be free, even though in another perfectly coherent sense, she is not free. How we view the nature of the human person will impact how we view human action. There are several models through which people have viewed the human person philosophically. Dualism, materialism, idealism, and hylomorphism. Dualism is the view that there are two separate substances that interact with each other when determining the nature of the human person. The person, precisely understood as such, is the soul that resides in the body. Materialism is the view that we are merely just a material constitution, that our personhood is reduced to the physical parts that make us up. And there's nothing else beyond these sort of corpuscular components of the human person. Idealism is the view that the human person and reality as such is merely just a mental factor, or is a composed of the stuff called mind. And then finally, hylomorphism, which we'll talk about. Hylomorphism holds that although the human soul is a special principle of human action, soul and body together make up the human person. On hylomorphism, the person is made up of soul and body, and the soul is the fundamental part by which even the body realizes its own identity. Or in other words, body is ordered to soul. For example, it is sensible to say that you have a hand to carry out the actions of your soul. That's, of course, just one way of understanding this. An advantage of hylomorphism is that it possesses the virtues of materialism, dualism, and idealism. For example, on hylomorphism, like materialism, it holds that we are physical things. It is similar to dualism in that it prizes the soul as an important part of the constitution of the human person. And it's like idealism in that it relates to the intelligible and the fundamental intelligibility of the world around us, as well as the intelligibility that is inherent to human understanding. Of course, some philosophers wonder if hylomorphism itself is a coherent position. For what it's worth, I actually think it is. What does hylomorphism amount to? Namely, that the soul is a special part of the person, such that the act of the soul is properly the act of the human being as a whole. This is possible on hylomorphism, since when the soul is the principle of action, it represents an action of the whole person, because the soul excels and incorporates matter in its operational powers, and the function and structures of the body are for the sake of achieving the intentions of the soul. So in light of this, how do we understand human action? Answer, as a version of agent causation. The view that the immanent cause of an action is the person as a whole. This view of agent causation is more fully illustrated by contrast to a non-agent causation view, a view in which an action arises from some particular part only. So, for example, on a non-agent causation view, actions are a function of a part of the individual, for example, a particular chain of neural structures and their interactions, or some particular chain of beliefs, some sort of inputs versus some sort of outputs, not the whole person, the person as a whole. Having identified a general metaphysical point about human action involving the soul and person as a whole, we now need to look at how parts of the soul interact as principles to produce an action. First, free will is necessarily dependent on intellectual operations. The movement from object to intellect to will and back to the object. Intellect is identified with truth and will with goodness. For example, let's say there's a hot summer's day, you have this delicious cone of ice cream. The ice cream is the object. It comes to be understood through the intellect and its interaction with that, with respect to the truths that come to be known about that ice cream. The intellect then, among its properties known about that ice cream, will recognize various features of that ice cream that are good. These good-making properties will be posited to the will with respect to the ice cream. The will then will move towards the object, motivating there to be some action performed in relationship to the ice cream, namely grabbing the ice cream, picking it up, and eating it. Sort of opting, you might say, opting for that ice cream cone. What this model tells us is that there will always be a reason for our actions. In other words, when asked why someone performed a certain action, it will never be sufficient to respond with, "I did it because I chose to," for no reason at all. Let's go a little more into intellectual functionality. Intellectual operations have some levels associated with them. Since we have seen a dependence of the will's function on the intellect, the levels of intellect will be relevant in our understanding of will and free will. There is a further level of complexity and composition regarding intellectual function. For example, at the first level of intellect, we have the function of abstraction. This is the feature of identifying generic features within percepts, or certain sensual, sensible features that arise in our minds. The next level of intellect is the formation of a proposition. This is the assertion of a proposition based on some type of comparison among concepts. So, you know, we think of an example of proposition, the dog is barking. So the feature of barking, the feature of being a dog, are united through some sort of comparison of barking with being a dog, and we form a proposition and then we assert it to be the case. And then finally, there is the level of judgment. This is where new assertions are based on comparisons of former assertions. So we compare propositions with each other, propositions that we understand or believe, and we, through the understanding of the relationship of those propositions, will assert a new propositions based upon it. This is what we think of oftentimes as deliberation or reasoning. Here is a little bit more detail on the intellectually foundational action of abstraction, which is a key point in understanding the function of free will. Abstraction is the apprehension of a feature that is indifferent to that which falls underneath it. So in this diagram here, we have food above peanut butter and jelly versus salad. There is a kind of abstraction that is related from the generic concept of food to its specific representations under them, namely being peanut butter and jelly sandwich or being some sort of salad. Food is generic, PB&J and salad are specific. In this lecture, we will call this relation the up-down relation. A key idea for our purposes in understanding free will is that of indifference. Food is indifferent to being PB&J or salad, since it neither fully excludes nor specifically includes each of these. Food is and is not salad. Food is said truly of PB&J, but is said of other things as well. But there's another relation that we need to point out, that of differences that fall under a genus. This is what we'll call the side-to-side relation. There is not an unambiguous path to either difference from the genus, and yet each of the differences are genuinely identified with the genus. You may think of a division of the genus into its parts. Remember that there are three levels of intellect relevant for our purposes. Free choice makes a special appearance at the level of intellectual judgment. One deliberates on a variety of assertions in judgment, determination of which is a chosen action. So let's say a person chooses to eat a second piece of chocolate cake. He eats it, say, after thinking about it because eating sweet things are pleasant and chocolate cake is indeed sweet. He decided not to go for the healthy choice, which is not so obviously pleasant, but would have been a perfectly good reason for abstaining from the second piece of cake. When doing so, a person is not choosing beyond reasons, but rather choosing among reasons. This involves the up-down relation to generic to specific. Seeking something pleasant is indifferent from various ways of realizing that pleasant experience. However, it also involves the side-to-side relation. There is a direct path from the generic to the side-to-side relation of one of the differences. That is to say, chocolate cake is indeed a particular instance of doing something that is pleasant. Choosing the chocolate cake is a choice of one of the side-to-side relations, and it is done for the reason of eating something sweet and pleasant. But are we really ultimately after chocolate cake or pleasant experiences? Or is it something more fundamental that we're after? And how specifically is this dependent on our intellects? We are fundamentally after goodness. and our will is fundamentally drawn to goodness as such. As a result of this, since goodness is what we always seek and can only be identified through the intellect, everything we do is for a reason. In other words, reason applied to action is just the way of finding the pathway to what is fundamentally good. As a result, to do something just because it is evil is just as impossible as doing something just because it is irrational. Given the strong view presented on the previous slide, we are left with the following question. Since the will is dependent on the intellect to identify what is good, and action involves the rational process of deliberation, do we even need the idea of free will? After all, couldn't we just think of there being some kind of inner process in which we make comparisons and then we terminate our process in the most reasonable one? Although this is part of the story, it isn't sufficient for human action. Remember the side-to-side relations of differences. Intellect is not going to be sufficient to choose because the up-and-down relation is ambiguous in relation to the side-to-side relation of the differences to its generic parent. It needs something in addition to this to opt for a particular opposing difference under the common genus. Therefore, we have evidence for free will as a distinct power from our intellect, our intrinsic ability to perform one particular action versus another when those actions are indifferent at the generic level. I have a nicely vivid thought experiment to motivate this, going back to the 14th century philosopher John Buridan, referred to as Buridan's ass. So in this example, we think of a very hungry, very tired donkey coming into the stable, and on the left side of the donkey, it sees a pile of hay. Simultaneous to that, it sees a pile of hay on the right side. Let's say there's a distance of, I don't know, say 30 feet between them. The donkey will be in a state of vexation because it is very, very hungry and all it wants is to eat this hay. But it can't bilocate. It can't go to both piles of hay simultaneously. It will be equally drawn to the one pile of hay as it will to the other. Now we imagine that this donkey does not have free will. It will be simultaneously drawn the exact moment to each pile of hay, and so will not be able to be pulled to one pile of hay versus another. So it seems that such a donkey, all things being equal, of course, smells each pile of hay at the same time. It sees each pile of hay at the same time. It's not left-footed or right-footed, right? It would seem that that donkey would starve to death because there wouldn't be anything that would make the difference between going to this pile of hay versus that pile of hay. So what conclusion do we draw from this thought experiment? Namely, that the up-down relationship is insufficient to reduce away the left-right ambiguity. Literally the piles of hay on the left and right side of the donkey. So we clearly see free will at work in Buridan's thought experiment, where intellect alone is unable to help one move to action due to its indifference to indistinguishable instances that fall underneath it. But you or I would not meet the same fate as Buridan's ass while constantly finding ourselves in the predicament of indifference between equal choices. Therefore, enter the distinct power of free will, a kind of counterpower to the power of abstraction. If we think about the diagram of the triangle I showed in an earlier slide, the movement from object to intellect to will and back to the object again, we see that the complete process requires entering into an abstract state by the intellectual power, but then exiting it back to the concrete by free will, in which a particular action is able to be executed. So just as particular objects are rendered generic and consequently indifferent to particular instances of those universalized properties, free will allows us to move from this state of mind of indifference to particular action that instantiates it. We've been thinking about the dependence of the will on the intellect up to this point. However, we need to think more about the interplay between intellect and will. But first, we need to provide a little more detail about how free will occurs within a broader context. 5. Free will is the choice of contingent means for achieving an end which is ordered to the necessary goal of objective happiness. Let's break down some of this vocabulary in this definition. Contingent versus necessary. A thing or event that could or could not come about. So that's specifically a contingent event. A necessary event is a thing that must come about. Means versus end. The former is done for the sake of the latter. Happiness, active and complete realization or fulfillment of one's powers or potencies. So we are always after happiness. Necessarily, and we pursue it by selecting options that are the avenues we understand will lead us to achieving that ultimate goal of happiness. And these will be understood as the contingent means for achieving the goal of happiness. A final bit of metaphysical context before we talk about the interaction between will and intellect that will help us along our way. Immanent realism, which accounts for what something is, its powers, and why a thing is moved towards another, is a very important concept. Immanent realism understands that forms reside within things. Forms ultimately are the principles of intelligibility, structure, and stability which have residency in the world perceived by us. This ultimately allows us to match up perception and intelligibility, mind, and perception. With this in mind, we understand that the intellect moves the agent as a formal cause, which is that by which something is of a certain kind. So in other words, the intellect grasps the forms residing in the thing, unlocks them in a way that is intelligible to us. It fundamentally identifies that which is the formal cause or the fundamental whatness of something or some action. That is, the intellect identifies what action has been performed and for what generic reason. In light of this, we get a kind of static and generic feel for the role of the intellect. Will moves, on the other hand, the agent as a final cause, which initiates an action for the sake of accomplishing something. That is, the will initiates the act in its movement towards the good and includes a particular reason for acting. Put this way, we get a dynamic and particular feel for the role of the will in action. In this spirit of the dynamic role of the will, as final cause, the will is the principle that pulls the agent past the generic limit of the intellect to a particular action. And yet, determination remains ubiquitous in action, as a covering principle. As formal cause, the intellect is the principle that allows the act to be fully determinative and delimited, namely, non-arbitrary. In this model, we understand that every action that we commit will always be within the scope of reason, because of this up-down relationship that the generic has to the specific. And yet, we want to make sure that we don't misrepresent the intellect and will as too independent of each other. It is way too easy to characterize this view as something like, hey, the will is the chooser and the intellect is the thinker, right? In opposition to this misconception, the will's per se act is the intelligible good, and this or that particular good is its per accidens act. And we understand per se versus per accidens just as sort of what is essential versus what is accidental or incidental. What this amounts to is that the will is always fundamentally about the ultimate intelligible good. It is a rational will. So even though will determines the left-right relation, it is choosing among things with reasons, which ultimately connect up to the intelligible good. To put it another way, although there is no unambiguous path from the generic to the specific, there is a direct and unambiguous path from the specific to the generic. Since goodness and truth ultimately coincide, the will is considered to be fundamentally ordered and amenable to reason. As the per accidens is dependent on the per se, free will is dependent on the intellect. Thus, all free acts are delimited. However, this doesn't leave free will out in the cold, but rather it plays a special role in particular action. Namely that free will regards what is contingent because instances that fall under concepts are per accidens objects of the intellect. One commits a contingent action, although it is both done for the sake of being happy, which is itself necessary, with full understanding that it is not necessary for happiness. We see that free will is sort of deterministic, but also sort of arbitrary. It is a kind of hybrid of both. So for our last point, reflecting on the nature and possibility of free will, let's circle back to the nature of human action in light of the nature of a human person as both body and soul. 6. The brain is the material cause of the soul. The material cause is the subject in which something exists. So when we say, you know, like an accident or something exists within a substance, or a, for example, one's knowledge exists within one's mind or something like that, right? That's the kind of the material cause being identified. The lower structures, for example, brain physiology, chemistry, and physics, are imposed upon and assimilated by the higher structures. And as such, the lower powers and structures of the brain will be integrated into the intrinsic operations of the soul. A clear example of this is the realization of perception beyond that of physiological sensation. Perception requires not just inner awareness of images, but also photons hitting the retina, etc. These physical processes will be incorporated to reach a higher synthesis in the act of perception. We can illustrate this with an analogy. Let's say you have planned a party. The structure of the room that you will have the party in will impose lower ways in which that party will play out. For example, if there is a large table in the middle of the room, the flow of traffic of the partygoers will be shaped by this obstacle. But at the same time, the table will be incorporated into the party. For example, you might place gifts upon it, you might have games with it, on it, etc. Let's recap to sort of pull these various concepts together in this sort of systematic understanding of free will. The ability to act otherwise has the whole person as its active principle by which what is generically considered as good is superseded by a movement towards some particular good, supported by a determinative reason for the sake of happiness, and occurring within the context of a functioning brain. Okay, so now let's look at some objections to the idea of there being free will. We begin with what I call microdeterminism, which is a determinism thought to come about as a result of the physical laws and interactions of bits of stuff under these laws. This determination is commonly understood to be inconsistent with meaningful freedom. This view is called incompatibilism. So there are some ideas working at this level that seem to yield determinism. First bullet point, the law of conservation of energy. No energy is lost when work is done. It is only lost in that particular form. The criticism goes that actions that could have been otherwise have the soul and not body as its source. This is, of course, in a hypothetical consideration. However, in actualizing a particular course of action by the soul, there would be some kind of outside energy introduced into the system, thereby breaking the law of the conservation of energy, and this cannot be done. The fact is, right down to the micro level, there is a finite system of particularly directed energies which cannot be messed with in any degree. The second bullet point, the causal closure under the physical. This view holds that any physical effects must have physical causes. And then finally, the third bullet point, the highly predictive nature of physics. When you treat the world around us in a physically deterministic way, as science does, we unlock considerable knowledge about the world and can make super accurate predictions about future events. Only think about the extreme precision that certain people, certain organizations like NASA has with respect to identifying planetary bodies, including their own satellites in space. Okay, so let's try some responses to the microdeterminism challenges. So the first one is this whole versus parts ontology. This is sort of a different paradigm shift through which I'm proposing that we understand the basic ontology of how these parts interact with each other with respect to the wholes. So the causal behavior of parts are determined by the wholes they compose, and so cannot be incompatible with the agency of the whole. So there's a lot in this one sentence. The general idea here is that we need not only look at the action of the whole in light of the action of the parts, but also the action of the parts in light of the action of the whole. It is possible that they are compatible. If they're not compatible, then I'd put my money on a wholes ontology over a parts ontology. Here's a dilemma. Either part-whole ontology is compatible or not. If they are, then there is no problem. If not, then whole ontology wins, since such a theory makes sense of purposes, namely final causes, and parts ontology cannot make sense of purposes. But if no purposes exist, then in principle one cannot assert that the parts ontology is true, since to do so would require a purpose. This, of course, is an adapted argument originating from the philosopher Norman Malcolm. So let's look at number 9, indeterminism at the microphysical level, as another way of addressing this criticism. The criticism, what I've called the microdeterminism challenge. So indeterminism at the microphysical level. And I take this actually from Sam Harris's book on free will. I'm using this as a way of actually undermining his conclusion that we have no free will. So this is what he writes. Heisenberg has observed that certain processes in the brain occur at random and cannot therefore be determined by environmental stimuli. So page 27. So this is just this leveraging of the idea of physical indeterminism that seems to exist, has been identified by these physicists like Heisenberg working at the microphysical level. So although quantum indeterminism is generally unheeded in the macro world of the five senses, that is to say it's not a phenomenon that we experience, the brain's deep intricacies and delicacy seems to be much more open to the influences of the dynamic interactions at this level. That seems to be a resource we could use to address the microdeterminism challenge. Next, macrodeterminism. Determinism eliminating meaningful free will entailed by movement at the macrophysical level. So this is from Sam Harris's book again. Some moments before you are aware of what you will do next, your brain has already determined what you will do. You then become conscious of this decision and believe that you are in the process of making it, page 9. For this reason, Sam Harris denies that each of us could have behaved differently than we have in fact done in the past. The basis of this assertion is based on experiments in the 1960s by a psychologist by the name of Libet. Basically, the experiments had the test cases sitting looking at a screen and recognizing that there is a clock, you know, noting the clock on the screen, and that person had to make a decision for when they were going to push a green button and then push the green button. And what they found more times than not was that the motor cortex of their brains were active several seconds, 6 or 7 seconds or so, before they, quote, consciously decided to push the green button. Now, since the motor cortex was active, that seems to recognize that they were getting ready to push the button, and they weren't even conscious that, but their bodies were already preparing to push the green button. Harris draws the conclusion from this that your conscious mind is always playing catch-up to your brain's so-called decisions, that our consciousness really does not make the decisions, it's really the subconscious brain and the various physical, chemical processes going on in your body. Slide 25. So what do we have to say for ourselves about this objection? Specifically, the objection in support of one, that each of us could have behaved differently than we did in the past. So how can we undermine this criticism of Sam Harris, supporting the idea that, yes, we could have behaved differently than we did in the past because we have free will? First, I think there are some serious troubles with lining up in a kind of one-to-one correspondence particular brain activities and particular functions of the mind. So this is number one. The individuation of brain activity and conscious thought is not clear enough to say that one indeed pre-existed the other. On one hand, as a lower potency, brain activity is too vague to identify with particular conscious choices. To say that the motor cortex is active is too indeterminate a power to determine a decision. Decisions are very complex. For example, stealing involves a whole host of components like intentions, abstractions, anticipations, all these sorts of things. The more complex the decision, the more vague the individuation of the brain states involved in that decision. For example, more distinct parts of the brain will be active in interacting with each other. The individuation of human action between brain activity and mental activity is further complicated in the kind of continuity that seems to exist between these two realms. This is illustrated with bullet point number 2, which states that habitual action is not contrary to free action. Just because someone lights up a cigarette habitually doesn't mean it's not a free choice. We let habit take over for less important things in our lives so we can focus on more important things or more complex things. A good example of this might be concert musicians. They have regulated much of their action to the level of habituation so as to focus on higher goals of dynamics, interpretation of the music. Something like this is likely going on with free choice to push the button at a certain time, as with these Libet experiments. This seems like a great kind of operation to relegate to a more autonomous operation in the brain. Finally, I have come up with a kind of kooky but sort of fun possibility that might mitigate this criticism. This is 3. Maybe special relativity is at play between the contexts of brain function and the context of mind function. There's the famous twin paradox that is a theoretical consequence of Einstein's special theory of relativity relating to time dilation. There are two twins. One stays on Earth and the other gets on a spaceship that travels for a while close to the speed of light. It turns around and comes back. The Earth twin is considerably more aged than the one on the ship. Perhaps this could be applied to what is happening between the brain function and the mind. The youthful twin is the mind, and the brain function the aged twin. Assuming that an aspect of consciousness is produced as a result of simultaneous neurons firing and connecting within the nearly infinite complex network, time passes slower within the frame of reference of the mind relative to brain activity. There may be further support for this in the fact that the more the brain is engaged, the more mentally present one feels in that moment, and time seems to move more slowly. So for this one, all I want to say is, take it with a grain of salt, a highly speculative possible response. A second denial of Harris is that we are the conscious source of most of our thoughts and actions in the present. He suggests that if we are honest about our own experiences of ourselves, we will admit that our thought life is rather random. He says, quote, "I cannot decide what I will think, I will next think or intend until a thought or intention arises. What will my next mental state be? I do not know. It just happens. Where is the freedom of that? In that," page 9. Our particular thoughts, intentions, perspectives, and attitudes do not seem to come from us. Rather, it is almost like we're watching a movie directed, scripted, and produced by someone else. And that someone else is, of course, dun-dun-dun-dun, the brain. Like a sci-fi movie from the 50s. In response to this, I don't think that this is at all bad news. It makes sense to me to admit that we aren't the conscious source of many of our thoughts and actions in the present, and that's why I change it by dropping the word conscious. So if you look at on the left side of the slide there, it reads that we are the source of most of our thoughts and actions in the present. I drop the word conscious out of conscious source. So as soul-body unities, although sometimes mysterious, they belong to us and are reverberations of past actions. Indeed, we are not perfectly transparent to ourselves. We are not moments in time, but complexes of past experiences and decisions. And yet, many of the thoughts that crowd our minds are consequences of previously conscious actions that we made in part at an earlier time. But at the end of the day, freedom is realized as the soul acting for the whole person within the scope of self-determination. We have souls that account for our whole personhood, and we can act for the sake of the whole in a way that is neither deterministic nor arbitrary. In fact, the concept of self-determination is really a synonym for these two features. This all sounds pretty good to me. I think hylomorphism really helps us out in this case, because the body sort of is accounted for by the soul. And so the soul and body interacting together is the human person, and so whether it's from the soul or from the body, ultimately it represents actions of the whole. Now, of course, there has to be some kind of conscious function here to free will. It can't all be sort of autonomous brain functions, at all levels of choice. And indeed there is, but it's going to be mitigated here by complexes of previous actions that we have made in the past, and it's a much more limited type of free will than maybe what we have thought within a modern sort of rationalistic context of free will, like one you get with Kant or maybe Descartes. So with all that water under the bridge, we end with this rather vexing third objection. It's pretty recognizable and is sometimes inaptly referred to as theological determinism. And this is the idea that all things are subject to divine providential ordering, and so nothing resists nor occurs outside of the divine will. Our question, of course, then is, how then can free will be possible? So here's a preliminary yet unsatisfactory answer. God moves human beings in a way consonant with their nature within a voluntary inclination of the will towards some action. So we bring in another mover into the mix. Remember that the intellect moves to action in different ways. The first idea emphasizes the point that human nature and its natural motions, which I've described in this presentation, are assimilated and not contravened with the ultimate ordering of divine providence. This is the idea of grace perfecting nature. God not only orders things in light of what will occur according to his providential ordering, but how it will occur. Free acts are the contingent means by which these preordained actions come about. Here we have a kind of parallel with the point made earlier that our ultimate end is the intellectual good and is the necessary object of the will, coupled with the idea that the means for achieving it is through contingent means. Similarly, God's providence and governance are necessary outcomes, but the means by which they will occur is through our free acts, which are, of course, contingent. And perhaps, these acts work in a way somewhat like the way I've described them in this presentation. Thank you for your attention.